as you can see, as we're coming up here, we're very familiar with each other, so we know our story. So I'll just set us up. I'll take 30 seconds to set us all up real quick. Thank you, Selena, for introducing us, and thank you, Black Caucus, for having us talk to you a little bit today. Oh, we got to go back. Damon, you might be first. Let's see. Now we might have to, we can go through it. We'll come back to it. As Selena has indicated, let's see if we get it there. Huh. All right, there we go. And we rotate it. As Selena indicated, we're at a historic time, both as a country, but also for the last, I would say, 6 years, the county of Cook and the state of Illinois, city of Chicago, have had three African-American men at the helm of each of their respective departments of health. Prior to this, one of our presenters that couldn't join us today, Dr. Eric Whitaker, who was formerly the state health director for Illinois, he and I walked in at the same time to lead our organizations. A year later, I think it was 2 years, was it 2 years later or a year later? We'll go with that. Whatever time period, Dr. Mason came along. Dr. Whitaker left and went on to the University of Chicago, and Dr. Arnold stepped in. So there was still that transition and still that cohesiveness that we, one of the things that we may not have the funding to do everything, but a lot of the barriers between all of our three organizations for the last 6 years, we don't pretty much tolerate them. We pretty much break through them and try to get our staffs working at the programmatic level to get going. So, and that leads us to some of the challenges, and we thought that we would spend our time, and we've presented several years now here, and the three of us to this audience, and we thought that we would bring some real practical experience about the challenges that we face as health directors, and how do we kind of communicate, work with you in terms of finding some of the solutions that we see every day. Dr. Arnold will talk a little bit about policy and funding. Dr. Mason will talk a little bit about community action around facing these challenges. And I will talk a little bit about the workforce. And let me just dive right into what I have to share with you. Let's see if we get going. Okay. What I'll spend the next few minutes on is just, if you ever, has anyone heard this term institutional inertia? I've heard it before, but I never heard it that way. I've heard it resistance and some other words. But in a conversation among the three of us and the four of us, Dr. Mason, Dr. Arnold say, it's institutional inertia. And so how this does relate to public health, and I think that's critical. If you're all, I don't know, how many of you are managers running programs? Do you have line staff underneath you? Any health directors? No? Okay. So the rest of the remaining of you are just the workforce. So we'll talk from there. So how does the institutional inertia within the workforce can affect a health department's need to realign its operation to meet long-established and emerging public health challenges with limited resources? And in that context, I thought I'd take the opportunity not to talk about what kind of workforce we need, but when you're running these large operations, when you go to make certain changes to meet the needs of your communities, there will be forces in your organization that may be resistance to change. And it may be the very public health workers we're talking about. So I will use a little case study to share with you about my department over the last 6 months, where we had to, we reduced our participation in the state's, not the Illinois Department of Public Health. I want to caveat that and say it's the Illinois Department of Human Services Family Case Management Program reduction. And through that process, I kept a little journal of, I won't say attacks, but really the issues from presenting to my governing board, to the union issues, to the workforce issues, as I was going around having town hall meetings, what actually everyone was seeing, where sitting at my level, I was able to see all of the story and see all the players and interact with them and how do we move about that. And how, and what was particularly in this case, I'm only going to share with you, is what was my workforce who participated in this program, were they really resistant to change and why? Real quickly, for all of you case management, we provided over for the last 15 years to all high-risk and Medicaid mothers and infants in suburban Cook County. The county of Cook is 900 square miles. Terry has the city of Chicago, which is roughly 200 square miles. It's all his territory. And the remaining parts of suburban Cook County, which is 700 square miles, is under Cook County. And then Damien's above us for Illinois. We use, in our case management model, a nurse model to interface with our clients, and clerks and health advocates provide support services to provide this delivery service. And what's critical, just sharing the little key bullet points, is that we had little or no staff turnover. What happened? Why did we have this case reduction plan? Well, with any grant, and I think that's a reality in public health management, that we need to look at some of these programs and begin to put some plans in place on how we're going to deal with them. In this particular case, flat funding from the state for the last 10 years from this state program, matching federal funds were in jeopardy. Our county fund contribution remained flat. However, the cost to do business has risen 5% or more each year. And I think that, and you'll hear from the three of us, that we don't like to talk about project management or business or any of those tools within public health. It seems that we are immune to that. But when the three of us are running our organizations, we have to run them like a business, even though we care about public health. And I think that gets lost in terms of trying to run these organizations. Also, in relation to case management, our mission and delivery objectives have remained stagnant, yet the following has changed. The new population needing services, if you know the county of Cook, we have O'Hare, we have Midway, we are the center point of folks entering the country. That's not saying they're going to stay with us, but they enter here, and we have to deal with the problems or the issues that they bring along, and then they may go out to the rest of the nation. And what's also key for the state of Illinois in the case of this case management program reduction is that health insurance for all is now offered to the same population. So this, imagine this program, in maybe your own states, we have a lot of programs starting to overlap each other because we're not getting together and talking and thinking about them in terms of a business model. In our case, as I said to you, that the case management program has not received any additional money. Well, that additional money went to funding all kids, all insurance for all. Well, then why do you need case management to do the same thing and creating pushing people into a medical home? So folks didn't necessarily see that. And that's been one of our issues going along, is what is really the goal and objective of case management going forward? Also, what's critical to understand this whole story, and I'm doing it very quickly, is that fewer staff, but with increased caseload. So when this program started back in early or late 1980s, it was recommended, or we started with 75 clients per nurse. Then there was a number that came out, I wasn't there, 150. Then as of 2007, we had 300 clients per nurse. But in order to keep matching the budget, this is the business side, I couldn't hire any more nurses because it was flat funded. So I kept increasing caseloads. The state knew this. So we're just going along this route. So with all this said and all the issues that were coming along, remember I remind you in the first slides about the financial issues. We had projected that in 2010 we would be out of this business. We financially could not carry it any further. I've done enough robbing Peter, pay Paul. We do this every day among us. But with the federal funding match being in jeopardy, I had to step forward and recommend to our governing board that to cease participation in the state program due to financial reasons, fiscal reasons, and overall agency financial viability. Now, what needs to be understood real quickly is that if they were going to give me the money, there are two things. One, if my governing board said continue to do case management, I had no problem with that. But show me the money. But the problem is I would also stood up there and told them this is the wrong place to put the money, because my particular health department does not have a primary care function. Because we are part of a large health system, it has three hospitals, one hospital jail, HIV core center, and our ambulatory care network. The public health department for suburban Cook County is strictly, in a sense, a public health department. But when we do case management, we are just a referral. So we're just contacting and meeting and putting people somewhere else. But how better would it be to put everybody in the same medical home? So if they were to sit here and tell me, give me the money to continue case management, I say, no, give the money to ambulatory network to have the continuity of care right there. So you're going to remind someone that they have an appointment in a place that they're familiar with. Not the health department saying you need to go over down the street. They have no connection. So that's that breakdown. So that's what I would have recommended if they had gone forward. And also what was critical, and I think in the loss of this decision, there was a lot of paper stories against my staff, against my management staff. What they didn't realize is that we had community providers who could step forward and provide the same service for the same dollars, even though our cost model was a lot higher. And then finally, we had to recommend the displacement of 100 staff within our health and hospital systems. And in this time, economic time, no one really wants to hear about layoffs and displacements. But because we were, again, in a large health system, we were able, one, if you were, we weren't concerned, our management team wasn't concerned about our nurses. If you're a nurse and you can't get a position somewhere, then that's another issue. It has nothing to do with, there's a nurse shortage, you should be able to transition somewhere else. However, our clerk and health advocates are who I was most concerned about. These are my entry-level individuals who don't have usually the skill sets to go on to different positions. But we were fortunate because of something else happening in our health system that there were positions available that we were able to displace everyone within. So it made the decision a lot easier for our governing board. Yet, there's some rational thought to this, but our workforce, who were particularly involved in family case management, saw this a little bit differently, and that's okay. So, they presented a concern for our clients. That was great. But ultimately, they weren't interested in their own job since no concessions were discussed. So they all stepped forward in the public hearing saying, Dr. Martin's against this, da-da-da-da-da-da. He doesn't like case management. He don't like mothers and children, all of this foolishness. But when I got him alone in the room, I said, what are you going to bring to the table? You've been receiving a COLA every year, and I've been warning you that you continue to do these COLA adjustments on these grant programs. We're going to have – something's got to give. So it wasn't a model like walking in like the United pilots or the American Airlines pilots and saying, look, in order for us to all continue this program, we're going to put something on the table. Well, that was never discussed. But again, when I announced that everyone would be displaced into positions, well, all the noise went away. There was no more criticism. It just went away. So was it about the clients or someone else's individual goal, which comes back to institutional inertia. Even though a few staff members were offered positions, they did not want that position because it forced them to give up a more convenient work schedule and other workload benefits not often outside the health department. And this is nothing against my staff. I love them. They're great. They're wonderful. But in particular, when you're a nurse working for a health department, you pretty much have an 8:30 to 4:30 or 9 to 5 job. You don't work in the hospital and have shifts and getting called on emergencies. So now all of a sudden you're being displaced back into a setting. Well, they didn't want to go back there, but they still want to. Interestingly, my nurses are paid the same as our hospital nurses. Well, the hospital nurses found out. That was a whole new issue, but I didn't want to get involved in that one. But also, the workload benefits are not they're not the same as you would work in a hospital setting for our nurses. So you had a sick caseload, you knew where you were going. So you could certainly say there were some larger benefits to work in the health department setting. So there was some resistance to that kind of change, that we had all these positions, but you didn't want to go there because it meant that you would actually have to step forward and do a little bit more. Okay. Family case management workforce felt that, and this is the most important point that I'll leave in about my talk, and I have a couple of slides that were sent around that, is that our workforce felt that they were the only individuals who could offer high-quality service for our clients. Our clients would get lesser service if they use other agencies behind the health department. And this is what I'm getting towards this institutional inertia and how, as you're making these changes at the management level, that you have forces coming at you that you didn't expect to actually kind of stop you in making those changes that you need to enhance the viability of the agency. And if my workforce felt that they were the only ones, when we had community partners out there who could do that, if our community partners could take this on, we can focus on other tasks that our community, that there's no capacity. So this feeling may resonate particularly for our workforce who are not involved in communicable disease, environmental health, and BT activities. That workforce understands, and I tend to agree with them, that that is our role. But some of these roles outside of that, we may be better in terms of assurance model or technical assistance. Also, as in the management level, we must be able to honestly assess our agency's ability to perform selected services when community capacity exists. So when we had said we want to use our community partners to provide the same level of service, and our health and our workforce is coming back and saying, no, we're the only ones that can do it, well, then we got a problem. Then our health department gets stuck because we can't make that change to meet the needs of our clients and our community. If our community can get up and be empowered to do this, why is the government going to stop? I hate to say this. Am I being socialist? Why is the government getting in the way of the community actually taking hold of their own health needs? And so that's the kind of thought we need to think about as we go forward. some of the comments that I heard, why didn't you, from my own workforce, I thought I would share with you, why didn't you talk to us earlier before you made this decision? Isn't maternal child health a mandated service? If so, why are we giving up case management? Why do we have to stop? What's going to happen to the health department? My performance is good, so why are we giving this up? So there were a lot of ranging issues, but these are the thoughts, and these are things you need to be concerned about if you're making these changes, to understand them, get out there and answer them, and kind of allay a lot of the concerns that as you're making these kind of strategic changes in your workforce, you can meet these challenges in order to meet these challenges. And centered around these three points is that in order to get over this institutional inertia, one, you must educate our workforce, including the field and programmatic staff, about the mission of your health department. More importantly, you must be able to share with your workforce that it's okay to be a trusted technical assistant for health issues to empower community as it undergoes a process of change. And then also, what's also missing in public health all the time is there is no money for staff development. So if we're going to talk about realigning and changing the mission, then we also be able to cross-train new technology, keep getting the skill sets up for our workforce to be able to meet our needs. So I'll leave you with this question, and I'll turn this over to Dr. Mason. Is our workforce ready to meet the operational challenges that require constant adjustment to ensure the best health outcome? And I just leave you with those two statistics from the Association of Schools of Public Health that, guess what, who's retiring, guess what's coming on board, and if we don't get our act together, we're going to be in trouble. Thank you.
Yeah, it's coming. Did I just click it there?
It should be coming up. Or him resume. Up there.
Up here?
Yeah.
Now, click this?
No, it's loading. It's loading up.
It is? Okay. I'll take
there you.
I'm going to pick up kind of where Steve left off, because I think that one of the problems that we have in public health is not thinking of it like a business. But I have a $250 million corporation that I run, and I have responsibility to the taxpayers, my investors, who we get that portion of money to do the things that we need to do. And we need to talk about a return on our investment. In other words, how have we been good stewards for the monies that we've used? And unfortunately, people in public health, I used to have this conversation with my colleagues that were in public health all the time or work in public medicine. And Claudia, you know, when you're in private practice, see, the public health folks would always say, how come you all don't want to see those people? How come you want to, you know, you turn away people that don't have insurance? When you see a relationship between what comes in the door and what goes in your pocket, you have a different attitude. People in the public sector get a paycheck whether they see one person or no people, or up to 100 people. And it's a different mindset that you get as a result of it. Just very quickly to sort of set the stage, when we look at what's actually killing people from a public health point of view, we look at these three things: tobacco, poor diet and physical inactivity, and alcohol consumption. Now, what that means is, as we go across the spectrum of things, that those things actually lead to, which is all that stuff that was on the other side in terms of cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and that sort of stuff, which is the medicalized version of what we're doing. But one of the things I wanted to do is we talk about the differences in death rates, and we had a lot of conversation about disparities, is I want to raise the question about the comparative population. And I think that what we need to do is change the conversation of the comparative population for all of these things. And the comparative population usually is white. And I'm saying that that's wrong, that the comparative population for anything that we're doing should be who is the best in that particular class. Not because I'm going to show you in a minute that that's not always whites. And so making whites and blacks equally as sick is not the way we should think of things. And if we look at just, for example, a snapshot of all cause mortality in the city of Chicago, you can see that, yes, black folks are above, but the Native Americans are right behind us. But then you have whites right behind them. And as far as I'm concerned, I would say that that's not the comparative population. I don't think our goal, though it should be perhaps a where we start, is bringing the black line back toward the white line. But I'm like, why can't we get down to the Asian line? That's the comparative population. So as we move forward with our conversation about eliminating health disparities, we need to be thinking about that. And that has some particular significance, because that tells us a lot about what we have to do. Most of what we have done, most of in the conversation, and I don't have to preach to the choir with this group, is in that 10%. In that 10% slice that we call medical care, we spend 15% of our GDP, roughly $2 trillion annually, in that area. And that only accounts, based on McInnes, only 10% of what makes us healthy. Now, the other piece is behavioral choice. A lot of people would have you think that those behavioral choices are things that you and I choose, but that's not true either. There are policies, advertising, and other things that guide those choices, specifically and purposefully, so that from a public health point of view, it's not about having nice little messages and quick little slogans to give people. That is not adequate. It's what are the structural changes that you do to guide the decision. And let me just say what are the biggest, I think, one of the problems that we have, and I'm sort of setting a lot of context around some things. We don't have this. We talk about it, but we don't have one, the healthcare system. What we have is what I call a DDAM, a DDAMS actually, a disease detection and management system. That's what we have. And what we've done is we've been sold or marketed by the medical community a bill of goods that says that early detection is prevention, but it's not. It's early detection. And we should not get those messages confused. The way our system works here, this is my own model here, so you won't find any book. But and I like that. I heard this sort of thing. But if you take this pyramid, and I call PHARBID, which is pharmacy, biotech, and medical device companies, and at the other part of the thing, you put providers, hospitals, nurses, doctors, nursing homes, everything that's done anywhere by two people, and then payers, the three P's: PHARBID, providers, and payers. Payers are the insurance companies, businesses, and things of this nature. This is our system, and what makes it go? Disease. It is only the only value proposition in this system is disease. There is no value proposition for cure in this model. So some of the conspiracy therapists have some of this stuff partly right, but we have to understand this is our system. And believe me, I'm not saying we don't need it. We obviously do. But what we've done is oversold this as a way that we can do the things that we need to do. And we've actually communicated wrong messages to people. Like, is mammography prevention activity? No, it's not. Is PSA testing a prevention activity? No, it's not. Those are all early detection modalities. They don't prevent anything. A mammogram is not going to prevent a woman from having breast cancer. It's going to help us find it early. A PSA may signal a problem with the prostate. And a cardiac stress test, well, actually, on the heart side, we are still, in my mind, in the dark ages as it relates to coming up with real early factors. We still have to talk about risk reduction and smoking cessation. But things like safe neighborhoods, those what we call social determinants. I'm so glad to hear this. Somebody put a term around all this stuff. But the social determinants of health are the things that matter. Now, why am I talking about all of this? Because even in public health, we still have a context of a medical model as we approach disease. And we, among anyone else, have to think about, we've got a whole new set of partners that we need at the table that aren't typically at the table as we go forward thinking about how we do this. And just parenthetically, talking to our family case management nurse, I have about 200-some nurses that go out and do family case management. When I talked to them about what the real challenges they had, the number one problem they had wasn't that the people didn't want to come to the clinic and all that kind of stuff. Again, medicalizing it. But if people are unstably housed, if they're living over here for 3 months and then over here for two more months, then the issue isn't about going out, and you could go out there all day long trying to find them to go to the clinic, but if you don't find a way to get some place for them to live, forget about it. So it means that we need to think about these things differently and not keep doing the same thing that we've always done, because that's the way we've always done it. Okay, so if we believe these definitions that we see about all of this nice stuff that we say, how do we then begin to think about our challenges if we really think that? So if we look at what's happening to man and the real challenge is manifested. Let me say it that way. It's manifested by obesity. Obesity in and of itself is not the challenge. It's the thing that causes obesity. And there are a lot of different ways that we have to attack this particular problem. And obviously, this is a problem that's gotten worse over time. And there are a lot of things, if we were to plot a timeline of all the activities, both at a many, many, many levels, and from childhood obesity, what's happening with children and what have you. And given where we are with childhood obesity today, it's likely that we're going to need another color in the next few months, in the next few years, I should say. So this, in my mind, is a major public health issue. And we can't decide on dealing with it from surgeries and medicines and things of that nature. So we have to think about how we go forward with this. Now, how do I go forward with this? Okay. And, of course, the surrogates for what happens with obesity are things like diabetes, and that turns into heart disease and all the other stuff that's medicalized. But you have to understand, I come out of the private sector for a very long time. But diabetes to Eli Lilly is a major profit center. Hypertension to Pfizer is a profit center. And the combination of hypertension and diabetes fuels the erectile dysfunction market. And it fuels all the things. And I'm not saying those things are bad. I'm just saying that's what it is. And we need to think about, from a public health point of view, how do we begin to deal with that? Not only is it just a disease that happens that people have to deal with, but now the business community is very interested in this because of what's called presenteeism. Everybody ever heard of presenteeism? Well, presenteeism is people going to work and you don't give a full day's work because you're sick. And these are the things. The number one thing that's causing, and they've actually quantified dollars associated with people coming to work with arthritis, or high blood pressure, depression, all the things you see listed here, what that costs per employee per year. So there is a tremendous need for us to begin to think about how we move forward from these things. And they're looking at that the majority of their costs are not costs from paying premiums for people going to hospitals, but it's for people coming to work and not doing a job based on their inability to perform it because of these problems that they're having. We know that public health works because most of the increase in life expectancy has been because of that. And if it works, most likely because we have been able to figure out what we should turn the spigot of disease off. And in Chicago, we've worked with a lot of created our own community partnerships with different communities around doing this part of engagement. And that's nice. And that makes you feel good. But there's some other things that we need to think about. How we restructure, so you got so many people, and this is some of the medicalization piece of it, but the business and technology improvement in the public health sector. You have people that have worked in public health pre-PC, at least in our department. And so the issues of how you begin to use technology as an enabling that asset, not to replace people, but as an enabling asset to help people do a better job. These are some of the challenges internally that we have to deal with from a public health point of view, because we are stuck in the dark ages on the public sector, as far as I can see, from looking at what's coming on in the private sector, and there's no excuse for it. The other idea is maybe we shouldn't be trying to do all the stuff, as Stephen pointed out. This whole notion that we can do it better, I don't think the data would necessarily support that. We started a conversation in Chicago interviewing all the CEOs of all the hospitals and all the FQHCs in the entire city. We have a report coming out. We'll be sharing that information. But basically, we will be saying, find out whether or not that's true. A lot of the clinics in place at the public sector were put there before FQHCs came out. And since FQHCs have come out, given the cost that Steve is talking about, I'm not sure that we're giving the best value for the money. All right. And so the other things that we should think about doing is how we collaborate on this medical model for what we need to do. But let me just stop it with this one right here. There are some metrics that we should use from the private sector in the public sector to help us get at the so what question. And we do have some public health metrics that we can use, but a lot of those are not tied to business metrics. And people say, well, people don't pay for it. Well, that's true, but are you standing there seeing the people for free? If you're seeing the people for free in a free place, then it's free. But if you're getting paid a salary, then it ain't free. So we need to figure out how we use that the best way. We're looking at other health kind of planning activities that involve people outside our typical sphere and questioning whether or not we can use for some of our facility development naming rights like they do for the sports stadiums and things like that, and silent partnerships to help us work on the uninsured and helping us to get the public health measure about. And then thinking about the whole way of partnership for disease control, using some of the infrastructure from our BT preparedness to deal with everyday problems that we have to deal with. And the question is, where do we go from here, given what we know we have to do? How do we begin to think about the partners that we should have around the table? What parts of the private sector do we need to use to help us do this? Because we're really all in it together. And I'll stop right there and go to Damon. Right. So we go to, Just go to the last slide.
Actually, we have, it's 12 o'clock and there's, the next group is actually outside waiting for us. Yeah, we went over our time. Dr. Arnold, if you could just come say one or two words to us, and then afterwards, they start at 12:30. We may have a few minutes. I understand that the slides are already loaded here, so we may have a couple minutes if you'd just like to say something briefly.
Yeah, and two slides, that's it. We get to...
Actually,
I started out with 50 slides, so I'll write it down to 13, and now I'll bring it down to 2.
Is this your last one? Policy Beyond Borders.
Yeah, that's it. There's a couple of things I have to say. Okay, and then just the down keys here. See, that's what happens when you have to use your glasses all the time now. I think it's right here. Yeah, I'm going to go down through some of the things that we have are disparities, like overeating and poor nutrition, addiction, mental illness, accidents, sexual practices. These are all self-inflicted behaviors. We self-inflict chronic disease. No question. Most of what we suffer from is self-inflicted based on our practices and our behaviors. And destiny equals your hand plus your behavior. So on the common portals through the mouth, smoking, overdrinking, overeating, all these things happen to be behaviors that are habituated around the mouth, the oral cavity. If you, if I ask you to spell this word, I'm going to ask you to spell some words and then ask you a question and answer it right away. And this is going to be a little exercise for you. Spell the word drop.
D-R-O-P.
Next word is mop.
M-O-P.
Next word is crop. You have to say it loud.
D-R-O-P.
Next word is drop.
D-R-O-P.
Next word is crop.
D-R-O-P.
Next word is drop.
D-R-O-P.
When you get to a green light, what do you do?
Stop. Stop. Oh.
Habituation in seconds. Think about what happens when someone gets habituated every second of every day to think they're worthless, they don't mean anything, that they have no place in earth, that when they're walking around that they're some kind of criminal. This happens to us all the time. So we treat stage 4 social disruption, not stage 4 disease. So racism equals moral bankruptcy equals mental insanity. I think that should be in the DSM-4, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. If you participate in racism, you're participating in mental insanity. But this is also some of the things we deal with: the dilapidated buildings, the poor education, geographic isolation, transportation issues, all these things. So discrimination is unconscious bias and stereotyping by healthcare professionals can influence diagnosis and treatment, perpetuating disparate quality and access to care. This is one of the things we have to break through, is the institutionalized dogma or historical perspective. Christopher Columbus, Woodrow Wilson, Helen Keller, Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein was one of the best friends of Paul Robeson. He was actually a co-chairman of the anti-lynching movement. If you look at Helen Keller, she was blind, she created Braille and that kind of thing, but she was also an abolitionist. She also was a person who gave money to the NAACP for its journals. She actually supported the women's suffrage movement. And then we have, I know we're running out of time, but I wish I had time to talk to you about these people. But read about them. Read about Woodrow Wilson. And read about Christopher Columbus. He came here 9 times. The second time, he brought 2,000 militia and killed close to 14 million people in the Central America over less than a 60-year period, 1493 to 1555. We have this kind of theory about where things are. Read this book, Armed Groups by Norwitz. It's $17, one of the best books you can read. He is one of the commanders at the Naval War College. It tells you a lot about why we have so much violence in our communities. These are some of the things that I've encountered when I was over in Iraq. These are landmines and throne mines and all this. We have this all over the world. This is a culture of violence. We have to stop that. We have to break this bridge, this gap, too, between the scientific how, because all of us are scientists and we think about things in scientific terms. But what the panelists were saying earlier is, you know, why does things happen? I give 41 grants to HIV groups, $50,000 to $1 million. And my question is, can you answer the question why? I can say 15 hamburgers a day, 20 years of eating them, you're going to be on my cath table, right? But when I go and tell that to someone in the community, they say, what do you mean stop eating hamburgers? That's the only thing in the area. And I have to eat these hamburgers before I pick my three kids up and get to my second job. So we have to be reality-based and answer the question, why should I not eat hamburgers? And we have to bridge that gap. So the grantees that I have, I think, have to be able to do that.
Have to be able to say, break this philosophical, theological, mental health, legal question of why. Because people see things as true or false. They don't see them as valid or invalid, like in a scientific method. We need to have compassionate, competent, consistent, and reliable health care. And it must meet the physical, psychological, and spiritual needs of disaster victims in a timely and sensitive manner. I started with preparedness because of my military background. But disaster, we're always in a state of disaster. HIV is a disaster. It's causing more deaths than, you know, a nuclear bomb is, right? We don't see that here. Take care of yourself. So these are some of the things that you need to do personally for yourself, for your home. And then also knowing a lot about these things in your community. You have to make sure that people understand where to go. With Katrina, I was down in Katrina, down in the 9th Ward. I tell you, it was devastating. People think that, you know, well, the government should have responded and everyone should be doing this. I got down there, hundreds of thousands of homes underwater. And the mass, the coverage, the area that was actually covered by this water was into the sunset. You could see it down into the horizon, how much devastation there was. So what I'm going to do is just keep going. This is a picture of Sumara in Iraq. And I could have gone a little bit more into the philosophy behind this, but what I encourage you to do is to start looking at it. There's another talk I have. I actually took the slides out of this one about a model, a healthcare model that's circular, that will go back into the community and come back into the public health arenas. What you can do for myself, I believe for Terry and for Stephen, there he's looking for him, but is make sure that when you're dealing with your local health departments and your health departments in general, is to make sure that you have culturally competent models that you're bringing forward. Because I could go downstairs, I could put 100 signs around here and say, stop smoking. And in 1 year, come back and look at those, and someone says, you know, Dr. Arnold, we decreased smoking by 50%. And I go, like, really? And I'm like, oh, good. And they go, they put me on the news and newspaper, a tick-to-tape parade and everything. And then they come back and they look at it and they find out that actually it decreased by 50% because out of that 50%, half of those died and the other half moved away. What does that have to do with reality, the metrics? We have got to become more metric-centered and understand what is the impact of what we're really doing. If we're putting money into something, why are we just throwing money out there with signs? There was one comment made by one speaker where you're saying that there was a thing, these signs don't work. The flyers. So why do we keep recapitulating those things over and over? And then we have 41 groups doing it. Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, did you answer the question? Because people in the community are going like, oh, it's another flyer. Okay. You know? Exactly. So, you know, I had this one, I'd say one more thing, but I had this one cartoon I did when I was in doing the public health, my master's of public health, and the cartoon had this one person standing there, and it had, like, it was a two-panel cartoon. And the first one was this guy standing there reading this thing and looking at this thing. It was a scientific paper. And he said, it was like, you know, with a high degree of probability and accuracy, I believe that you will become, you, you, substan- you, you,
you have a reasonable risk of dying soon. And he's standing over a gravestone. So the research is great, but you have to make it practical. And on the other side, you know, you can have a person that's standing there, and you can say, well, you know, you know, this thing is going on where you are in a situation where, you know, I'm going to give you this this cowhead pill to take care of your arthritis. And you have no conception of what's inside of it. No research has been done. It's a balance between the two. And it's not as easy as people think. Even with HIV, which we were talking about, you have a double-edged sword. Because one side of your sword says that this thing is a killer. It can take you out of this world. It's going to destroy you. And the other side of the sword says, we have cures. We have treatments. You can live with it. So we have to be very careful about dichotomous viewpoints when we start putting those things out, too. But that's all I'm going to say for right now. Thank you.
We'd like to thank you all for attending our session. We want to thank all of our presenters on today, and see you all next year.